As usual, we are all gathered here today to listen to another exposition of the Lord Buddha's teaching. Before we begin today's sermon, let us all take a moment to remind ourselves and reflect upon the infinite virtues of the Perfect One, the Most Magnificent One, the Infinitely Compassionate One, the Undefeated One, the Unvanquished One, the Impeccable One. This is the Perfect One, the Gautama Supreme Buddha. Let us take a moment to recite the stanzas that were once uttered in answer to the question, "Henceforth, who is your teacher?" A question that was asked of Upali, the householder, and with the same conviction, honor, pride with which he answered that question, today we shall do the same. So let us take a moment to pay veneration to our Master, our Teacher, the Supreme Buddha. Let us be upstanding then to recite these stanzas. Seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, and continue with today's proceedings.
Dhirasya vigata mohasya pabhinnakhilasya vijita vijayasya anighasya susamachittasya buddhasilasya sadhupanyasya vesantarasya vimalasya Bhagavato tassa savako hamasmi akatankatissa tusitassa vantalokamisassa muditassa khatasamanassa manujassa antimasarirassa narassa anupamassa virajassa bhagavato tassa savako hamasmi asansayassa kulassa venaikassa sarati varassa anuttarassa ruchira dhammassa Nikhankasa Abhasakarasa Manachidasa Virasa Bhagavato Tassa Savako Hamasmi Nisabhasa Appameyasa Gambhirasa Monapattasa Khemankarasa Vedasa Dhammattasa Sangvutattasa Sangatigasa Muttasa Bhagavato Tassa Savako Hamasmi Nagasa Pantasenasa Kina sanyojanasa muttasa patimantakasa dhonasa pannadhajasa vitaragasa dantasa nippapanchasa bhagavato tassa Savakohamasmi. Isi sattamasa akuhasa devichasa brahmapattasa nahatakasa padakasa pasadhasa viditavedasa purindadasa sakkasa bhagavatotasa Savakohamasmi. Isi sattamasa akuhasa devijyasa brahmapattasa nahatakasa padakasa pasadhasa viditavedasa purindadasa sakkasa Bhagavato tassa savakohamasmi. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Please repeat all together and after me. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Saranagamanam sampunnam. Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinnadana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Kamesu micchachara veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Musavada veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Surameraya majjapama dattana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Tisaranena saddhim panchasilam dhammam sadukam surakkhitam katma appamadena sampadeta. Okay, you may all not be seated. Let us now take a moment to invite the many countless beings in the 10,000 world systems within earshot of this sermon. Let us invite them with gratitude as among them will be those who will have been parents to us, siblings to us, our friends and our family. In this long journey in samsara, those who will have helped and supported us, been by our side, and have come to our rescue in the most difficult and testing of times. Today we owe them a debt of gratitude, and it is therefore our duty to invite them to join us. As this meritorious deed is about to unfold, let us invite them to join us and witness this meritorious deed and acquire merits, in the hope that such merits may help them to redeem themselves from the woeful planes in which they may be today, and be born in the blissful plane. There may be those also in the blissful plane. Let us invite them to join us and listen to this sermon, understand it and comprehend it, and may they all be able to achieve the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So as I now make this invitation, I ask you all to extend that invitation in your hearts and in your minds out to all of them, to join us, to witness this meritorious deed, to rejoice in the merits, to listen to and understand and comprehend the sermon, the teaching of the Buddha, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata saddhammam munirajasa sunantu saggamokkhadam dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta. Okay. And now let us take a moment to seek forgiveness from the Noble Triple Gem and the other noble ones for any thoughts, words or actions of revile, desecration or insult we might have directed towards them. As in this long journey in samsara, we have almost always been in the association of ignoble, immoral people. These associations defiled our minds with desire, aversion and delusion. And having been blinded with ignorance and attachment, on countless occasions, we may have made such mistakes. The consequences of such actions may be that today, as we make an effort to move forward on the path, that becomes incredibly difficult. So therefore, let us take a moment to seek forgiveness from the Noble Triple Gem, the Sammasambuddhas, the Paccheka Buddhas, Arahata Buddhas, Anagami, Sakrudagami, Sotapannas, be they on the path of having attained the fruits, as well as the Buddha's ministry, the Sambuddha Shasana. Let us take a moment to seek their forgiveness for any misdoings, words, thoughts or actions of insult or offense, slander and revile that we might have directed towards them. And as you take a moment to seek that forgiveness, let me urge you to make a firm resolve to never conduct yourself in that manner ever again. And finally, let us all make a firm resolve that may, through the course of this sermon, if there have thus far remained gaps in our understanding, which have kept us from achieving the noble states, then may through the course of this sermon we be able to fulfill those gaps and achieve sight of the Four Noble Truths. And for those who may have already achieved that noble state, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill the subsequent stages, and may we all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. With that resolve in mind, I invite you all to prepare yourselves to listen to this sermon. Okay. I'm going to pick up one of the questions right off the bat, and that'll take us forward for the rest of the sermon. Theravan Sarnai, most venerable sir. I have recently started listening to your sermons, and it's been 5 days since I started meditating, and what I mostly do is look at what goes through my mind and understand them in terms of the workings of the five aggregates and three roots of defilement. Today when I started meditating, my mind got stuck in one rupa, which was of my long deceased grandmother, whom I was very fond of and attached to. I couldn't proceed beyond this, even though I tried to look at it in terms of the nature and cause of attachment. This particular rupa and its associated chitta just very stubbornly remain etched, and I got panicked and came out of my meditation. I was too agitated and scared to resume meditation. It would be grateful if you could advise me as to how I could handle a situation like this and proceed with my meditation, with metta. Okay. Now the most important thing we need to understand, folks, is when we set out to do something, we need to first have a clear idea, a purpose, intent, direction, and what the goal, the aim of it is, the why we are doing it, of anything really. So unless we have a clear idea as to what we are trying to achieve by doing something, the why we are doing it, what we are hoping to get out of it, two things can happen. One is you may start going down the wrong track, or perhaps you might start initially with good intention, but soon after you might start digressing. And secondly, when you don't start to see results that you expected to see out of it, then pretty soon you'll lose trust, you'll lose confidence, and you'll lose interest. And the danger of that is also twofold. One is you may never try that again, and secondly, your opinion you may feel like sharing with others. So the same applies in the practice of meditation. A lot of the time what we see is people go into meditation not knowing what meditation is. Sometimes they got a hunch just by listening to someone, maybe a TV program, maybe something they read in a magazine.
And then they thought, I should also try this. And, you know, the thing is with meditation, it seems virtually harmless. Because you're not essentially using any tools, per se. You're not using any instrument. So you're not ascending any heights as such. So it seems like, you know, you don't need to really get any practice or you don't need any instruction. Unlike if you were to use a tool. If you were to use a hammer, for instance, it's important, this is obvious, that one needs instruction. How does one use a hammer? Because if you don't, then you could end up hurting yourself. Or even if you were to climb up a ladder, if you don't use instructions, or if you don't get instructions, or if you don't use safety gear, then chances are you could hurt yourself. But the thing is, with meditation, it seems virtually harmless. How could it hurt anyone? You just see someone sitting under a tree. They look very harmless. They seem to be able to ignore everything that's going around them. And so people feel that no harm can come out of doing meditation as best they think. It ought to be done. But I would like to argue that the opposite is true. In fact, you could do more damage, more harm, not only to yourself but also to others, through meditation than you could with a piece of heavy equipment or a saw or even a hammer or anything like that, or even a chainsaw. You could do more harm, more damage through meditation if you don't do it properly, if you don't understand what you're doing. Because remember, with meditation, you're almost engineering the mind. This is sort of mind surgery. And there's nothing more dangerous, nothing more harmful than a person who's lost their mind. By losing one's mind, of course, what we mean here is where they've gone mad. And yes, today it's quite common to hear of people who have gone into what they call meditation, so-called meditation, and they have gone crazy. They all did it because they thought, no harm can come out of this. It seems perfectly harmless. You're not even coming into contact with anyone, so no harm can quite possibly come to anyone. And you're not harming yourself either. All you've got is perhaps your legs crossed, one hand on the other, sitting in a posture which seems very appealing, and we've seen yogis sat like that. So, and yogis are very harmless people. So it must be that nothing harmful, nothing wrong can come out of meditation. But as I say, I think the opposite is true. Meditation can be dangerous. It's not is dangerous, it can be dangerous. In fact, it could be very dangerous. If done incorrectly. Because what you're doing is mind surgery. You're opening the mind up, running a thorough examination of it. And actually, what you're hoping to get out of meditation is to change the way you think, right? So if you are what you think, then by changing the way you think, you're completely changing your nature. At the end of a meditation session, or a series of meditation sessions, it is quite possible that some people start to see all sorts of weird things. So these are not things that they see through their eye, but things that they see through their mind. They're mental hallucinations, but of course to the person hallucinating, they don't realize this. They think they've just started to see weird things through their eyes. Remember, you're meddling with the mind. So, is it possible to go insane if you meditate? Yes, absolutely. If you do it incorrectly, you could go insane. If insanity is losing your sanity, and to be sane is simply to be able to do things in a coherent way, things that make sense. And if you lose that, which can happen if you, essentially you're reprogramming your thought process. That is what people do when they think of meditation. A lot of people, what they want to do is reprogram their thinking. And even in Buddhist principles, Buddhist meditation, it is about reprogramming your thinking process, your thought process. But there's a right way to do it and there's a wrong way to do it. If you do it the wrong way, the consequences can be catastrophic. I stress this because it quite literally can be very damaging. It can leave a devastating effect on oneself as well as on others. Families can fall apart. And particularly if, say, someone in high authority, someone with power vested in them, say the ruler of a nation, or someone with a great amount of responsibility vested in them, were to incorrectly reprogram their mind, then their thought processes change, they're altered, and before you know it, you could end up with a machine that's connected to a distorted mind. You know of people like that. You know how powerful the mind can be when applied to a cause, either to the right cause or the wrong cause. If you apply your mind to the right cause, you can do a lot of good to yourself and to the world around you. And equally, if the mind is applied to the wrong cause in the wrong way, then it can cause a lot of damage. You could even end up with murder. You could end up with people disowning their families. You could end up with people going on a genocide spree. All sorts of things can happen. So the mind is a very versatile, a very powerful force. Of course, we know with great power comes great responsibility. So when you have so much power, when you have access to so much power, it's important that you handle it the right way. I've heard of people who meditate incorrectly and then they've gone and taken their life, jumped off a cliff, hung themselves, or perhaps even drunk poison. And just before they did that, they poisoned the rest of their family, their parents, their brothers and sisters, and even their little toddlers. So, of course, I am very keen on you doing meditation. You know this. That's why I urge you to do your 15 minutes every day. But I'm even more keen that you very carefully identify, understand, and clarify the kind of meditation that you ought to be doing. That is why it's important to take instruction. Why? Particularly because you're meddling with your mind. We don't want anyone going insane. Least of all, you'd want that. If you are what you think, and then your thinking process is being re-engineered, reprogrammed, you've got to be careful when you do that. Wouldn't you agree? Right? Sometimes people who live very normal lives, normal in a conventional way, they live very normal lives, and all of a sudden the thought appears to them that they have to meditate because everyone's doing it, so I shouldn't be left out. So then they start meditating, and then soon enough they start living a very abnormal life. They start to show the effects of their meditation outwardly. Most of the time, right, one of the best ways to identify if you're going down the wrong track is usually if others know that you're meditating. Now, not just because they see you meditating, I don't mean that. But if others begin to see the effects of your meditation in a way that they find disturbing, they find out of place, in a way that they find is bothering or worrying them, chances are something's wrong with the way you are meditating. Because through your meditation, you should be able to become a person that is more acceptable. To others around you. A person that is more appealing. A person that is more welcoming to others around you. However, if through your meditation, people begin to reject you, people begin to dislike you, the way you talk, the way you behave at home, and if you somehow feel superior to others, and others around you start to feel that they're inferior to you, all of these are telltale signs that something's wrong with the way you meditate. If through your meditation you start to become anxious, you start to become scared, you start to become nervous, you start to get fits. If your body starts to go cold, or areas of your body start to get locked up, all of these are telltale signs that you're doing your meditation in a wrong way. And you need attention. You need help. Now, I'm not saying all of this is answer to that question. But as the question has come up about meditation, and I think it's come from a new listener, I thought perhaps a few bits of advice to those who like to meditate will be most useful. So this is some good advice for all. Those who are in meditation already, those who want to start or pick it up in the new year. And even to those who are regulars to meditation. If you are open to new ideas, then you may be able to get something out of this. After all, if you feel that I am fixed in my opinions and I don't want to change my opinions about anything, I'm always right in the way I do things, then again, that is another sign that you're doing your meditation wrong. Even if it's about your meditation. It could be a sign. Because when we meditate, remember, this is about reprogramming our thought process. And through the reprogramming of our thought process, we become more accepting of others and others' opinions around us. We become more considerate to others and others around us. We become more aware of others and others around, of others and their opinions. We go from being hard and adamant individuals to people who are soft and very flexible, always willing to change for the right cause. If it's the right thing to do, always willing to change. If these things are not happening through your meditation. It does not matter whether you've been doing it for the last 500 years. If this is not happening to you, then chances are you're going about it the wrong way. If people at home are complaining that you have become less friendly and that you have begun to alienate yourself from them, chances are you've got it wrong somewhere down the line. See, all these virtues and the good qualities that we talk about all day long, about becoming a good husband, a good wife, a good friend, a good brother, a good father, a good mother. What is good is usually dependent on what the other person expects of you, to some extent at least. So if these things are not happening through your meditation, then you've got to stop. You've got to stop and recalibrate yourself. Something's wrong. If the way you talk to your wife has changed, for instance, you used to call her darling in a very loving way, and because you start to meditate now, you call her madam, or you call her Mrs. and her name, or you call her Upasika, whatever. These are all signs that something's wrong with the way you meditate. If you attribute these changes to your meditation and you feel that you're becoming a more pious, more religious, more docile person, then I beg to differ. I think we need to take you back to the garage. We need to get that bonnet opened up and get a good examination of what's going on, because something's not right. It can't be like that. You can tell a good meditator when people around them begin to feel their love and affection much, much more than they used to. When people around them feel that they care about them much more than they used to. If a husband has begun to meditate and he's been doing that for some time, and the wife feels that more than he used to, he cares about me now. It used to be that he was very adamant about things. It was always his opinion. He was never willing to change. He never considered my words, my thoughts. But now all of that has changed. He's more accepting of me. He's more accepting of my flaws. That is the sign of a good meditator. And if you're still at work and your boss has begun to complain that every hour or so, he goes missing. And then when we go looking for him, he's in the canteen meditating. Or the last time they found you, you were in the toilet meditating. Then something's seriously wrong about the way you meditate. The first thing to understand about meditation is there's a place and there's a time for you to sit down and meditate. You can meditate around the clock. Every waking hour you can meditate. But if you feel that meditation involves sitting down cross-legged, shutting your eyes, and disconnecting yourself from the world, There may be the time, there may be a suitable time for that, but it's not every time, not everywhere, not with everyone. We do it from time to time, as monks. We practice in solitude, from time to time. But that does not mean that's the only time we meditate. So, I want you all to make sure that when you approach this subject of meditation, you approach it correctly. Because done incorrectly, you will break yourself in a way that no one will be able to fix you. You may break yourself. The mind is a very fragile one. The tiniest of vexations it cannot bear. Don't forget that. And remember, you're dealing with a mind that is ailed with ignorance. So it's very difficult to trust your thoughts. Because after all, ignorance is seeing what is false as true and seeing what is true as false. So whenever an ignorant mind or a mind in which ignorance prevails offers an idea or an opinion or a thought, you got to weigh it up properly. You got to be very careful. Sometimes you'll feel like doing things. That's the worst thing you could do. And yet, because of ignorance, you'll feel like that's the best thing you could do at that time. And go ahead and do it. I'm not trying to put you off meditation. In fact, the opposite. I want you to do meditation. The reason I'm talking about this is, if you do it correctly, you will do it for a long time. As in, not long time in one sitting. What I mean by that is, you will like it, you will enjoy it. And you will do it for a long time. It will become a life habit. But if you do it incorrectly, then you won't be able to do it for long. Because before long, you will lose it. If you have started to talk to yourself and everyone does a bit of that from time to time, I don't mean that. If you just started to talk to yourself, if other people at home are complaining, why are you talking to yourself? And it's not something you've done before, but you've started doing it since you started doing your meditation, then best thing to do would probably be to stop and go and get some instruction, go and get some advice. If you started to see hallucinations, if you started to see colors, vibrant colors, patches of red and pink and blue and yellow all over the place, if you all of a sudden begin to think that you're really ugly, if you start to see your body as a festering wound, a pus-oozing, festering wound, wherever you look at your body, you see that, then best you stop your meditation and go and get some advice. If there's nothing else you can do at that time, then sleep. That's better than meditating. These are, you know, all of these are symptoms of meditation done incorrectly. Now we get informed of these things from time to time. Again, I repeat, this is not directly about or an answer to the question from the person who's asked this question. I'm giving you some background. And as the question has been raised, I'm answering questions from a lot of people around this topic. Or I'm trying to, at least. Some people start to feel their eyes twitching. Some people start to feel that they're levitating. Heck, some people begin to think that they can fly. And the next thing you know, the guy's trying to climb a tree. Because he believes he can fly. And he wants to jump off the tree and prove it to himself. If ever these thoughts come into your mind, then stop meditating. What's happened is you've messed up. If you feel, for instance, feel like you now need to eat from you have to change your dietary habits. Say, for instance, everyone at home, you've always eaten what everyone else at home has eaten. And now because you're meditating, you feel that you have to take a special diet. That you have to switch from rice and curry to maybe grass and mud. Stop meditating. Something's wrong. Because people don't eat like that. That's not a normal diet. If as soon as you start meditating, you think, okay, right, to do my meditation, I should go vegetarian. Okay, stop. Stop meditating. If you feel you have to start walking backwards, or you got to dress inside out, like you've got it wrong. Something's wrong. So before you proceed, go and get some advice. Go and get some advice, particularly from whoever inspired you to meditate. You would have learned it from someone. Because on the outside, if you begin to seem very different from those around you, then something's wrong. See, I said, of course, that we isolate ourselves from time to time, because at the monastery, that is normal. But I would never have done that at home, because in a home environment, in a lay environment, within a lay community, that's not normal. People don't isolate themselves like that unless they're going on holiday. Because at home, you are with your family. So, you know, the odd half an hour, maybe a day or two, with prior permission, and if everyone's accepting of that, then perhaps. But if somehow you feel like you want to isolate yourself for an entire month, then before you proceed, stop and go and get some advice. You remember when you used to come to the Samma Samadhi programs at the monastery? How much advice you get right at the start of the program? And some programs, we've done more talking than meditating. Meditating in the sense, closing your eyes and reflecting on your own. We've done more talking than the latter.
You know, I've seen some people who they claim to be advanced meditators. And they sit down to meditate. You look away and you look back at them after a few minutes, and all of a sudden they start dancing. They're drawing circles in the air. And the problem is, they feel that they're doing it right. Reason? They've never got instruction from someone. They just thought, this is what I should do when I meditate, and they just went ahead with that. And now they've corrupted their own mind. Who's going to fix it now? Worst of it is, they don't believe something's wrong with them. It's too late for that sometimes. And on some occasions, we've had people who come to the monastery. They're looking for an opportunity to meditate. And we realize that really, before they start meditating, they need to get their basics right. And then when they... Sometimes they're adamant that, no, it's meditation that they've come here to do. So we give them some time, all right, go and meditate. And then we see them going through a breakdown, an emotional breakdown. Sometimes they get shivers, stiff necks. The entire body goes cold. They start to see flashes of light. And then they come and say, this is the way I meditate. And so they share those experiences with us. And then when we try to explain to them, whoa, hold on, something's wrong. Let's go back to square one. They don't want to listen. Because they believe they've got it right. You know, one of the most vital qualities you need to have as someone who wants to meditate is the humbleness to listen to a teacher. To accept that you could be wrong. And then, when we tell them, no, you're not doing it right, so why don't we just go back to the sermons? Let me explain to you the basics first. And then we get to know sometimes that they've gone away, and then they complain that this monastery is not good for meditation. That we don't let people meditate here. This is very serious. It is so serious that because of people who do it incorrectly, meditation is picking up a bad rapport. People are becoming discouraged to meditate. And non-Buddhists who believe that Buddhism is all about meditation, when they hear horror stories like this, and they get to see people who meditate and they living a lay life, living a home life, then they don't wash, they don't clean themselves, they don't shave, they don't brush, they don't eat.
that they're trying to live the life of a hermit, but in the household, people who see this, they find this very distasteful. And of course, it's no wonder that they come to the conclusion, Buddhism is for lunatics. Look at this guy. He was a normal person. He used to go out with us. We used to be friends. He'd be fun to hang out with. But look at him now. He's lost the plot. Completely gone mad. And then people completely lose trust in the philosophy, in Buddhist teachings. So really, you know, people who do it wrong, you know, you can end up becoming a disgrace to Buddhism and to the Buddha. So it's very important, folks, that we understand meditation properly before we get into meditation. That's why I, on plenty of occasions, have said, rather than use the word meditation, when we, at our monastery, I like you to use the word contemplation. Because that takes away all that baggage that's associated with meditation. All the things that are conventionally attributed to meditation, like sitting cross-legged, holding your breath, sitting up with your back straight, closing your eyes, that all those things that go together with this term meditation, which are commonly associated with meditation. I like for you all to put all that aside and instead use the word contemplation. Because with contemplation, that's a wholly mental affair, and you understand that that has nothing to do with your physical or outwardly expression. So how can you start to get shivers when you contemplate? How can you get a stiff neck when you contemplate? Are you contemplating with your neck? How can you get palpitations when you contemplate? You're just reflecting on something. It's like working through a math problem. How can you start to see flashes of light? I've heard all sorts of weird and wonderful things from people. I'm saying, you know, I'm giving you these warning signs because I don't want any of you falling into these traps. So this is not an attack or a negative remark on anyone. My intention is, by sharing these stories that I've heard, these horror stories that I've heard, either I've seen by myself personally or I've heard from other monks, from other senior monks in other temples and monasteries, people who come and spend time there for meditation and so on. These are some of the horror stories we get to hear. I'm sharing them with you because I want you to be careful. Remember, you're reprogramming your mind. There is nothing more powerful than the mind. You'll recall this from the Upali, the Householder Sutta. When one of Nigandhanatha Putta's disciples visits the Buddha for a debate, and he engages with the Buddha in a debate, and he wants to prove that the body is more powerful than the mind. Time and time and time again, the Buddha proves to him that no, it is the mind that is more powerful. Remember, it is the mind that went on to become a Buddha, and it is the mind that went on to become a Hitler. Take away the mind from the body, that's just a dead mass. A mass of muscle and bones, that's all it is. The mind is supreme, the mind is most powerful. It's a lethal weapon, it can be. Why are people in prisons today? Is it because of body or is it because of mind? How did an innocent child go on to become a mass murderer? Was that a body or was that a change in the mind? There are more illnesses of the mind than there are of the body. To this day, people haven't fully understood the mind. Certainly not scientists. They still struggle to figure out how the mind works in connection with the brain and the rest of the body. So really, even the so-called scientists, they understand very little about the mind. Otherwise, why do they put a pill through the mouth to cure a problem with the mind? One is mental, one is physical. So whenever someone says, I'm going to meditate, that does send a shiver down my spine. I feel for them. Particularly when they're new to the Dhamma. The other thing is, you know, when you've started meditation, now you're all by yourself, right? So, in that moment, you don't feel like going and asking someone, and it may also be that you don't have access to someone to go and get instruction from. So you're all by yourself. When you're in the middle of your meditation, you don't feel like, you know, you want to go and ask someone for help or ring a friend, ring your teacher, and get up from your meditation and go and check something out. But say if you are trying to fix a computer and something's not working out, right? Before long, you're going to pick up that phone and you're going to ring someone who knows. But when it comes to meditation, people don't feel like they ought to do that. Because people feel this is my mind. I'm the master, I'm in control. And I know myself is how people feel about themselves. Little do they know that whenever they say, I know myself, they have hardly understood themselves. That's the biggest lie there is on this planet. I know myself. I and myself are the toughest beasts to tame. You know this. I mean, you know, how about if you have a habit of biting your fingernails? Try and give that up first before you start to meditate. See if you can manage that. I mean, you want to try and reprogram the mind, right? How about giving up biting your fingernails first? See if you can manage that. And then try meditation. Stop biting your fingernails for the next 6 months. and then try meditation? If you have a habit of swearing when you get angry, see if you can stop that first. I'm not saying stop getting angry. Okay, get angry, but maybe not use swear words. See if you can try that first before you start meditation. I mean, start on the little things first. Before you completely shut yourself off from the rest of the world, from your teachers. You know, you're literally shutting yourself down. Or at least cutting yourself out. You close your eyes. Sometimes people even use earplugs. They want to shut out all noise. You have no idea, folks, the stories that we get to hear from people who come and talk to us about meditation. This is why I'm emphasizing this point so much. And there's also the other side. There are sometimes evil forces. Now, the skeptics among you may choose to ignore this part. Fair enough. There are sometimes pretas who will want to take revenge sometimes for misdeeds that you've done, as a result of which maybe that they are today having to suffer. They're looking for an opportunity to avenge you. And then when they realize that you are of weak mind, you're a novice to this, you have no teacher, no instructions taken, and you're just blindly going into meditation. They're able to do things. They're able to influence your thoughts. And they might even be able to influence the creation of mental hallucinations. And in your hallucinatory world, you'll begin to see sometimes the Buddha. Little do you know that this is a trap. You'll begin to see hallucinations of the Buddha, but your mind is now not ready or willing to accept that this is simply a hallucination. Because, after all, you're seeing the Buddha, right? And no one else can see the Buddha. I can see the Buddha. My friends can't see the Buddha. Not even my meditation master can see the Buddha. My teachers, they've never said that they were able to see the Buddha. I can see the Buddha, so surely I must be special. That is how you all feel. I must be special. Whenever you feel that I must be special, yes, you are special. Just put another word after special, special needs. You need help. So you start to see an image of the Buddha, and sometimes the Buddha will start to talk to you. He'll even address you by name. And then sometimes you might even start to see other gods. Deities and Brahmas, all of these are hallucinations. I'm saying maybe. Okay, let's say there's 1% who actually see them. Okay, but of course you can't see the Buddha. He's passed into Parinibbana. There's no way you can actually talk to the Buddha now. But, you know, see, again, but the moment I say there's one, you know, this just the 1% that may be actually able to see it, everyone who sees it believes that they are the 1%. That's the problem. Because everyone likes to believe that they're special. When you go forward in the Dhamma, you begin to realize there is no such thing that is special in this world. To nature, nothing is special. Everything is very normal. Although the coming of a Buddha is very special to us, to nature, that's a very normal thing. And every few million eons, they chuck a Buddha in there to balance things out. To maintain equilibrium. But more on that later. Coming back to our so-called meditator, they begin to see these hallucinations and they feel that they're very special. And sometimes they'll say, oh, today in my meditation, so-and-so, this God, came and spoke to me. And he even said that he was my uncle in my previous birth. And so God came and spoke to me. And he said that he wants to be my servant. And he said that he'll be there wherever I go. He'll always walk with me. And then the next day, another God will come and say, whenever you want to fly, just jump. I'll catch you and I'll help you fly. I'll just come under you, and then when you just need to tug on me, and then I'll fly wherever you want me to fly, and then you can then go to places. Like that. So now this person believes that they can fly. Why? Because a God told them that, surely. Gods don't lie. So what does the guy do? He climbs on that tree. He climbs onto the tree and he wants to jump now. Because he's just been told by a God that whenever he wants to fly, at your service. Don't fall for any of these things. And even if you have a meditation teacher who starts to brag about things like this, like they have just been addressed, they've just been spoken to by a Brahma who was their father in the previous birth, and you know there was another Brahma who was he was his wife in the previous birth. I mean, they don't even have husbands and wives there. So if you have a meditation teacher who starts to brag like that, then I say reconsider your options. I have no right to say that anyone's lying, so I don't say that. But reconsider your options. Are you there to hear about people boasting about themselves, or are you there to learn about meditation and how you can free yourself from suffering? If you use meditation for what the Buddha preached it for, the Buddha introduced it for, you'll be fine. If you use meditation for other things, then you're on your own. We certainly can't help you there, because we don't use it for any other thing. After all, meditation is reprogramming your mind. When you reprogram your mind, which is the most powerful thing on this earth, you got to be very, very careful. If you lose your mind and you die in that state, there's no saying where you'll end up and for how long. I've heard of people who meditate and they contemplate on the putrid nature of everything. That's what they call the pilikul bhavna. And the poor fellow can't even eat from that day on. Because whenever his mother serves him a plate of whatever food, he looks at his plate and all he sees are worms. A plate full of worms. And that is all rotten. So he can't eat from there on. And then he loses his appetite. And he starts to wither. Then the parents take him to the doctors. They try and treat the fellow. But now it's too late because mentally he's lost it. Now no matter what you try and feed him, whenever he sees food, whenever the sign of food appears in his mind, all he can see is rotten, putrid, stale, sometimes feces on his plate. So from there on, he can't eat. And then they put him on saline, they give him vitamins. But for how long? And then the parents start to get angry. They get frustrated. They start shouting at him. You know, poor parents. They want to do what's best for their child, and all their life they've been trying to bring him up to be healthy. And because of this meditation, completely the opposite has begun to happen. So they get very annoyed, very angry. And then it only ends in a very sad way, those stories. I'm telling you folks, I have seen this with my very eyes. The effects of meditation gone wrong. And on most occasions when I see things like this, and you try and talk to those people, they're not willing to budge. They believe they're right. Only because they feel something that others can't. And sometimes they feel that the reason we are trying to prove them wrong is because we are jealous. So you try and talk to someone who starts to see ghosts or other apparitions in their meditation sessions. You tell them, you know, I think you're doing something wrong. You shouldn't really be seeing all these things. Why don't you stop focusing on that and maybe come back to the basics, right, of what are some of the things you want and just contemplate on that. You can tell what they're thinking. They're thinking, you're just jealous, aren't you, Swami Nahansa? Because you can't see them. That's why I say meditation can be a lethal weapon. It is more dangerous than the coronavirus. It is more dangerous than any weapon I know. Because it can completely derail the mind. It can make you go insane. If done incorrectly. I'll emphasize that, if done incorrectly. But most of the time, I'd even say 80% of the time, when people approach meditation, they go into it blank. They have no idea, not the foggiest of ideas of what they're about to do. And I feel sorry for them. But, and also, you know, there's some, you know, people will generally not like others influencing their spiritual opinions and thoughts. You know, a man doesn't mind you talking to them about, talking to them and trying to change their opinion on what they'd like to have for dinner. But tell a man that they're meditating wrong. They're not willing to accept that. Because there's a huge part of ego that goes with that. Someone who believes they meditate, they're a very advanced meditator. Ask them to stop meditating for a week. They might even get angry. Reason for this is because there are not things that everyone does, right? Things like meditation and spiritual practice. Conventionally, people who engage in such things, like meditation and reflecting on the Dhamma and things like that, right? Immediately, they are raised to a level of authority in society. Not because of their virtues. Necessarily. But just because they meditate, I mean, let me give you an example, right? So say, in your hometown, let's say there's a man that you know of. He's always dressed in white, and he's famous for meditating. So he's always known to meditate. You don't know what the hell he's meditating about. No one knows, really. But he's meditating all the time. When you go to talk to him, would you talk to him like you would with just any other person? Or you feel a sense of, you know, an unusual sense of respect. An unusual feeling of respect towards that person. I'm not saying they're not deserving of respect. Anyone who can leave aside a sensual life and at least try out a life of spiritual practice is worthy of respect. But just because they meditate, sometimes people feel that they ought to be treated with utmost respect. So in society, people like that are given a high place in society. And most likely people don't want to argue with them, or they don't want to question them. And so when someone is known to be a meditator or a yogi, sometimes they get onto their moral high horse, and in society they remain unquestioned. Their intentions, their practices, they remain unquestioned. And sometimes that can be very dangerous. Can be very dangerous. And when they feel that sense of authority, they will use that to start to act as a teacher or a master, a teacher of meditation. Do you think that everyone who's set up a meditation class in their town or wherever, do you think everyone who's set up a meditation class knows what the heck they're doing? I mean, it's so easy to set up a meditation class. Sometimes all sorts of mischief is probably happening. All you got to do is book a hall somewhere, hire some place for that, and send out some invites, or put up some posters, get some word of mouth out there, and gather up a few people who are keen on meditation. You should start off with 5 or 10 odd people, and then they'll sit them. Usually, this is how it happens. You know, they'll sit themselves at an elevation, higher up to the rest of the class, and sometimes they might even sit down in a very awkward posture. They'll even have these hand mudras, like pretending to be some kind of saint, and they'll give you a good talk. And then they'll say, okay, now you can close your eyes all. Everyone close your eyes. We are now going to start meditation. Sometimes there may be a tape playing in the background, some sort of chanting. Or even they might start chanting something. So now what you've got to do is hold your breath for a few minutes and maybe reflect on that. And sometimes these classes are for ladies only. Interesting, these ones. The master is a gent, but the classes are for ladies only. You get them also. So, and it's very important that you keep your posture properly for this meditation. So after you start your meditation, when you start to hunch your back, the master is ever so kind that he'll walk up to you and he'll adjust you. He'll make you sit up straight. He'll help you get your back straight, making sure that every part of your body is in the right posture. Legs, arms, back, chest, stomach. And if you are already in the good, in the right posture, he might even give you a pat on the back saying, well done. Maybe even a kiss on the forehead. Just an extra bit of encouragement. Why ladies only? Did you not question that? I'm not saying everyone's like this. But I'm saying you've got to watch out for these things, folks. Right? You've asked us to take you on a journey to Nibbana. So I've got to give you advice just in case you fall into Gombana. So, watch out for these things. It sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And if you are particularly good looking, then chances are you also get special instructions after class. Special instructions. Where they might even teach you how to meditate lying down. And then they'll still come and adjust your posture. Watch out for these things. Don't fall into this trap. Because in your keenness to meditate, there's a wide variety of things that you need to watch out for. There's a whole gamut of areas in which you can find pitfalls. Watch out for them. I'd even go as far as saying, if you're going to meditate, only use meditation as a means of getting rid of suffering. Getting rid of desire, aversion, and delusion. Once you've mastered that, and after you become an arahant, then you can try out meditation for other things. Like levitation, walking on water, like creating the objects, teleportation, and seeing other beings with your divine eye, or opening your third eye. Now, perhaps meditation can be used for all sorts of things. I'm saying you've got very little time, and there are people out there who are waiting to mess about with you. So how about you put two and two together, and I suggest let's just use meditation to rid the mind of suffering. When the mind is free of ignorance, then the mind will be able to make the right call. Because it's very easy to fall into these traps when your mind is ignorant. In one of those meditation classes, you could be, your instructor could say, oh, this student, she's very good. She's one of my best. And with all that encouragement, with all that praising, it's very easy to fall into that trap of, well, if I like to be praised, my teacher is praising me, so to remain in his good books, I better do as he says. He's asked me to come for the special meditation class. which is after the normal meditation class. So I better go to that as well. He said he's going to teach me how to open my divine eye. Be careful, he just might. So I'm trying to make you aware of all these pitfalls, folks, so that you can watch out for them and take good care of yourself. Remember, I said, you're a very valuable person, both to yourself and to society, because people like you are not very common. People who are interested in their salvation and in helping others achieve the same. But we must realize that in this journey in samsara, we have not always been truthful and honest with others. On countless occasions, we may have deceived others and used deception as a strategy to achieve our own wants and desires. So, of course, other people will do the same to us. What you give is what you get in the end. So as we have been like that in our journey in samsara, we must be very careful. We've not been saints, but we have on countless occasions pretended to be. So you will not always come across saints, but you will come across a lot of people who will pretend to be. What you give is what you get. And especially when it comes to meditation, because it is such a high profile, everyone wants to do it, everyone wants to try it, everyone thinks it's the path to freedom and ultimate mental satisfaction and happiness. And it's so hyped up, isn't it? Everyone wants to do a bit of meditation. It's almost like life isn't complete unless you've tried a bit of meditation. Most people in their lifetime will have gone on at least one retreat. It may be a day retreat, it might be a week, perhaps a month. A meditation retreat, where most times you will be met with a yogi, some kind of meditation master. And then they'll give you some instruction, they'll give you some advice. And that advice can be life-changing, both in a positive way or a negative way. The danger with this is, with meditation, you're meddling with the mind. The mind is the most powerful tool at your disposal. There is nothing more powerful at your disposal than your mind. It can make you, it can break you. It can heal the world, it can destroy the world. A single mind is enough to do all that. Have you not heard there are some gods who have so much power they could destroy the world if they wanted to? That's one God, one mind. We've seen humans do catastrophic damage. And they've left scars on human history, on the human race. And all of humanity had to pay for it. We've seen humans like that. In the end, that was the mind That was the culprit. So when you try out things with your mind, you know, it's not so dangerous to go and try out different types of food. That's not so dangerous. There are some restaurants that serve 1,500 dishes every evening. That many varieties. You can try them all out. That's fine. At worst, you fall sick, or you might get a heart attack. That's the worst case. But you will remain sane. When you do things that meddle with the mind, you have to be so very careful. But people take more precautions when they take physical risks than when they do mental risks. How many driving lessons does one take before they get into a car and they're given a driving license to drive a car all by themselves? I remember when I took driving lessons, my instructor said, you've got to take twice as many lessons as your age, at least. But how many meditation lessons does one take before they sit down on their own and start to meditate? How many sermons does one listen to before they sit down and start to meditate? One at best in most cases, but sometimes none. Because they see people meditating in these glossy magazines. Or you go on YouTube and they say they have meditation music. I mean, I don't get what that is all about. What's meditation music? If they have meditation music, why don't they have meditation food? That's what they should have added to Pizza Hut's menu. Meditation pizza. A bite of this and a bit of meditation. A bite of this and a bit of meditation. I don't get that. Because it's so hyped up, everyone wants to do it. I'm not saying that's necessarily wrong. It's good. Everyone wants to do it. That's good. But not everyone wants to do it the right way. They just want to do it. Problem is, if you go into it at haste, you can regret at leisure. And you'll have your entire life to pay with it. Meditation is a very sacred thing. It has to be done correctly. Please understand why I'm saying it and why I'm emphasizing it this way. With meditation, you're meddling with your mind. People take more precautions when they get into the shower or when they go to brush their teeth than they do when they go to meditate. Sometimes people don't know what the hell they're doing. They'll just sit down, close their eyes, and they'll start meditating. And before you know it, you've lost it. And some people, you know, no instruction, no teachers, people start to feel energies from all over the place. And I've heard some people say that I feel energy from all over the place. Everything's vibrating. They'll say I can feel the earth vibrating. I can feel the trees vibrating. The chair that I'm sat on is vibrating. I can feel all these energies, they're passing through me. For 3 years I've been a monk and I've meditated. I've never felt any energy passing through me. And I've never seen any spirits. I've not seen any ghosts. I've never seen any patches of light. I've never felt that I've levitated. I've never had a stiff neck, or eyes twitching, or palpitations, or sweating, or my body cooling down or heating up. I've never had any of these experiences. But I've meditated all right, and I've got results to show for it. I've never felt like I now need another plate to eat on, like different to everyone else, or a different meal to everyone else. I've not changed the way I talk or the way I walk. I've never seen any gods. Listening to me, yes, I know some people will probably say, see, he's just jealous. He's never seen any of the things that we've seen. Is he just jealous? But my point is, meditation was not introduced by the Buddha for any of the above things. It was given to us by the Buddha. It was prescribed by the Buddha. Really, meditation should only be taken on prescription. Honestly. Meditation should be treated as a prescription drug. It's a procedure after all. To treat an ailing mind. So you have to be very careful. Once again, I emphasize, this is not me trying to talk you out of it. I want you all to be able to do more of it. But you can only do lots of it if you do it right. If you do it wrong, before long, you will lose it. And then there will be no meditation to do. They'll take you and lock you up somewhere safe. We've had to be so strict about this, so much so that in our Samma Samadhi programs, when people come in on the start of the week, we actually get them, just before they leave the program, we get them to sign a document to say that they're of sane mind, and we get them to promise us at the start of the program that they will only do as we instruct them to do and nothing else. So when we say start meditation, they got to start. When we say stop meditation, you have to stop. And when we say this is what you're going to be contemplating on right now, that is what we want them to be contemplating on. And then throughout the program, at varied intervals, we keep asking them, what are you doing right now? What are you thinking about? Talk me through this problem. How did you manage to work out this problem? Because we treat meditation as working through a math problem. because we use it for only one purpose, and that is to free the mind of suffering. So you remember from last week, it is not necessary to fix the mind on any one particular thought. Or to rid the mind of particular thoughts. So you don't need to stick to one thought in your mind, or one thought object at least. That is not necessary. The purpose of meditation is to contemplate all thoughts. So going back to the question, what I mostly do is look at what goes through my mind and understand them in terms of the workings of the five aggregates and the defilements. That's a great start. Because before we figure out what's wrong with it, we need to examine it. Learn to read your mind. Observe the thoughts going through the mind. Be aware. You will identify there will be thoughts of desire. That's when you want something, and generally when you got what you want. When you've got what you want, you'll have thoughts of desire. That might not necessarily be that you have got it into your hands, but you'll have got the sight of it, or maybe the sound of it. Perhaps it's someone you'd like to be with. You can see them, but you can't touch them. Still, thoughts of desire will be going through your mind because you've got what you want, at least the sight of it. Taste, smell, touch, and so on. Then you'll have thoughts of aversion. When you'll want the opposite of what you've got. When you'll want something other than what you've got. So you have something, but you want the other thing. Meaning not in addition to what you've got, but instead of what you've got. So thoughts of anger, resentment, frustration, annoyance, all these things. Are representative of thoughts of aversion. And then you'll have thoughts of delusion. These are really difficult to spot. Generally very difficult to spot. Most of the time it's very subtle. You can spot them usually as one of their most common manifestations is that of ego. A sense of feeling that you are superior to others or that you are inferior to others. These are easy to spot, easier to spot than others. It is generally an awareness of oneself and how one compares to others. It is also the state of mind when you're unsure about what you've got, whether it's something you like or whether it's something you dislike. As I said, this is the delusion part. It's a lot more subtle than the other two. But as I said, ego is one easy way to spot it. When you feel like you want to compare yourself with others. This is a great place to start with meditation. Because this is where you're doing a triage. So anyone who's worked in a medical setup will be familiar. In a ward, for instance, you have a triage facility where you assess the level of attention needed to restore to normal. How much care, how much attention, how much treatment is necessary. And it's when you do that, you get an idea of how severe the problem might be. And also, then it helps you to go and get help from a teacher. Because you can now come clean with your teacher. You can go and explain to your teacher how you feel, your thoughts about the world around you and about yourself. Whether you have more thoughts that are more inclined towards the desire end of the defilement spectrum, or more towards the aversion end, or more towards the delusion end. Now, if it were the Buddha, you wouldn't have to have that conversation. He would know straight away. But with everyone else, it helps if you can explain what's going through your mind. So that's where you start. And then, remember what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, about how it works. Ask the question how, not who. So when you catch these thoughts in action, ask how. How does this work like this? So, for instance, let's take an example. Let's say someone's invited you for lunch and you have accepted the invitation. And now in your mind, you're immediately starting to think about what sort of things you'd like to have for lunch when you visit them. What would you like for lunch? So now you have thoughts of desire, surely. That's what's going through your mind. I'd like some of this, I like some of that. Oh, I wish they'd make this. Last time they made this, it was delicious. Hopefully they'll make it again. So these are thoughts of desire. And then perhaps once you visit them for lunch, and you see those things served on the table, then again thoughts of desire. And then when you eat them, thoughts of desire. So these are thoughts of desire. One of the best ways of meditation, best methods of meditation that you can do, is ask the question, how, and come up with an answer. The process of doing this is meditation in itself. See, I'm telling you, when you do this, you're not going to have a stiff neck. If, say, for instance, it was some sort of pudding, biscuit pudding. Let's say that was on your mind, and you got it served at the lunch, and now you obviously had thoughts of desire, or you're having them as we speak, and then you're now shifting your thought process to, how is it that I'm feeling this? How is this happening in my mind? Go through the process of, I'm enjoying this, surely. These thoughts of desire mean I'm enjoying this experience. So this enjoyment is a sensation of pleasure. How do I feel pleasure? You know, you have proved it to yourself, hopefully by this time, that pleasure is simply the product of relief from vexation. So it is relief from vexation that has brought you this sensation. So these feelings of pleasure, of these feelings of delight that you feel, that your mind is telling you you're getting from the food that you're eating, it is incorrect. The call, the judgment, the decision that the mind has come to at this point is incorrect, that it is something that you experience from this food that you're eating. Because you know better. You know that pleasure is the result of relief from vexation. So this delightful taste, not the biscuit pudding taste, but this delightful taste, this taste that you find delightful, or this experience of delight, that cannot be coming from the biscuit pudding. You know this now, and therefore you are applying that knowledge. You are applying this insight into your real life experience at this point. And this is what meditation has to be used for. This is how to use meditation. Meditation is a tool. Use it correctly, you'll get your job done. Use it wrongly, you can hurt yourself. You can cause yourself no amount of damage, or rather, no end to the amount of damage you can cause yourself. If you use it wrongly. So you're having that pudding, and as you have it, now you see this is the important bit. You don't have to abstain yourself from having pudding. That is not necessary. If you were to, for instance, right, serve a biscuit pudding for alms to an arahatan vahanse, do you think he's going to reject it? Do you? Because it's very tasty and he's tried to keep away those defilements from his mind. And he doesn't want delightful taste. He doesn't want to experience that because it's forbidden for him. Do you think he's going to reject it? No, he's not like that. If it is an item of food that does not cause him any physical harm or damage, then he will accept the pudding. And while he's having it, he'll experience the taste of biscuit pudding, but he's not going to experience a delightful taste. Because you didn't add an ingredient called delight into your pudding, did you? But that which was not added to the pudding, you experience now. How is that possible? Yes, you can experience salt, you can experience sour, you can experience bitter, you can experience sweet. But how can you experience delight? That was not an ingredient. Now, this is what you need to catch. This is why I said you need to be aware of your thoughts. So, you see, your thoughts are now picking up a delightful taste, meaning there's a bug in the program. Your mental thought process is bugged or is buggy. There's a bug in it. There's something wrong in the code. Because that which was not added to the pudding, you should not be able to experience. So what must you do now then? You must reprogram your mental process. Now, this is why I warned you right at the beginning. People who have not understood the Dhamma, let me tell you how they're going to reprogram. Chances are they'll reprogram. Pudding is like feces. Because I shouldn't be liking pudding. Because pudding is a sensual item of food. People enjoy it, so therefore I should not enjoy it. Therefore, pudding is like feces. Pudding, whenever I see pudding, I should think of a festering wound. When I see pudding, I should think pus. When I see pudding, I should think of a toilet or a cesspit. And that way, whenever I see pudding, my desire for it will be gone. Because it's yucky, it's dirty, it's putrid. That's where people get it wrong. Most of the time, that's where people get it wrong. And then what people will do is, initially they'll say, you know, I've stopped taking pudding now, you know. And why is that? Oh, because I'm meditating now. I've given up my desire for pudding, so I've stopped taking pudding. Sorry, I've got to say, you've got it wrong. You having stopped taking pudding is no evidence at all to prove that you have given up your desire for pudding. That is no evidence at all. You have given up your taste for pudding, your desire for pudding can be proved if and when you are served pudding and you eat it, but you don't experience pleasure. You don't experience a delightful taste. You can experience the taste of pudding, but you don't experience pleasure. Then you can say you've given up your desire for pudding. And that has nothing to do with rejecting pudding. But if you point blank say, no, you know what, pudding, no. I have forbidden myself from taking pudding because I've given up my desire for pudding. What's all that about? Now what you have is a dislike for pudding. Now you want to reject it. That is another defilement. Now you got to start all over again. Because what you tried to get rid of was the pudding. Whereas instead, what you really needed to get rid of, was the desire for pudding. In other words, the taste of pleasure when you have it. The experience of pleasure when you have it. That is what needs to go. Not the pudding. And not even the taste of pudding. The taste of delight, the taste of pleasure. So that is what you need to be aware of when you have your pudding. And if you are aware of this, so essentially, how is it? Remember, ask the question, not what, not who, or rather not who, ask the question, how? How is it that I experience the taste of pleasure, this experience of pleasure, this delightful taste? Ask yourself how, and then you will get the answer. The answer being vexation and relief from vexation. Relief from vexation is what I experience now as pleasure. So it had nothing to do with the pudding itself. Because vexation was not an ingredient of the pudding, and neither was pleasure. Neither of these two things should you be able to experience by having pudding. The ingredients of vexation are ignorance and attachment. So where did they come into the picture? Was there ignorance and attachment in the pudding? No. Attachment is a mental function. Attachment, though, is caused by ignorance. Where ignorance is the idea that pleasure is to be found in pudding. That is completely wrong. It's a lie, it's a flaw, it's completely wrong. But hey, that's what ignorance is. The truth it will show as false, the false it will show as true. So pleasure cannot be sought from pudding. But what does ignorance say? Pleasure can be sought from pudding. That is why the indoctrination, pleasurable, is responsible for this vexation. Joyful, that is why this indoctrination is responsible for this experience of pleasure. And essenceful, that is why that indoctrination is responsible for this experience. So that is what you need to contemplate. So you see now, it's a contemplation, isn't it? You're not holding your breath, you're not standing on one leg, right? You're not shaving off your head. Or rather shaving your head. No, you don't want to shave off your head. Right? You're not changing the way you walk. You're not changing the way you talk. Nothing. This is a contemplation. No amount of doing this will get you to see flashes of light. What's the connection? How does pleasure arise in my mind? How does contemplating on that begin to show you flashes of light? How does it make you levitate? What's the connection? How does it start to make you see demons or spirits or ghosts? What's the connection? Because this contemplation is based in insight, in wisdom. That is what you need to do as contemplation. That is what your meditation ought to be. So, as I said, mostly, so going back to the question again, and what they are doing at the moment is I look at what goes through my mind and understand them in terms of these workings. Fantastic. As I said, that's a great start. And then identifying the defilements. And then add to this what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. How is this happening in the mind? So you see, when you realize that this pleasure that you experience is a relief from vexation, would you want that relief? Would you want that pleasure if it's a relief from vexation? When that pleasure was not brought by the food, by the pudding, it was brought simply by the relief from vexation, would you want that pleasure? Because that pleasure has nothing to do with the pudding. It's got all to do with vexation. So if you like that pleasure, what you're saying is, I like to be vexed. You don't want that. And when you see it that way, you'll no longer be desiring of that pleasure. You'll no longer be desiring of that pleasure. People go after this pleasure because they don't see that the source of pleasure was a relief from vexation. They believe that the source of pleasure was the sight or the sound, the smell, taste, the touch, all the sensory inputs. People believe that is the source of pleasure. That is wholly incorrect. But it's only once you've seen this, once you realize this, are you now prepared to contemplate in this manner. Now, I gave an example with the pudding. Of course, you know now, you can substitute pudding with whatever you like. A sight, a sound, a smell, taste, touch, whatever. Whatever you like, just substitute with it. That is meditation. How difficult is that meditation? How much of that meditation is too much? You understand that makes, even that question itself makes no sense. Right? For as long as you experience pleasure, is as long as you ought to be doing that meditation. In other words, once you become an arahant, you can stop your meditation altogether. Because meditation is a tool to get you to arahanthood. Then again, there are thoughts of aversion. So you wanted that pudding, but there's no pudding today. Or it could be that, say, for this may have happened plenty of times in our lives. I certainly remember in mine as a young child, where your mother promises you that she'll make something for tea. In the morning, she says this, so I go to school, and then all day long I'm thinking, right, just need to wait till tea time, I'm going to get it. And then you get back home, and then along comes tea time, but not the thing that she promised she'd make. And how do you feel at that time? You feel disappointed. Frustrated. Annoyed. These are thoughts of aversion. Again, first of all, identify. Recognize that this is a thought of aversion that's going through the mind. Once that is identified, now ask the question, how? How is this happening? How is it happening? This feeling of frustration, annoyance, and disappointment, was it brought by the pudding? Was it brought by the mother? No. How come your younger brother, who was not promised this, does not feel this way, but still, no pudding made at home? How come he does not feel this? And for instance, if he does not like pudding anyway, he feels nothing about it. So how is that possible? That's possible because this feeling of annoyance, this feeling of anger, this feeling of disappointment is not something that came in the pudding or it came with the mother. It was simply an attempt was made to relieve oneself from vexation, but that attempt has failed. So therefore, the feeling of vexation is now presented, magnified. All hope has been lost. All hope of achieving that pleasure that you thought was going to be gotten from the food is now lost because that food is not going to be made available. But this is because you believe that it's the food that was going to bring you the pleasure. But now you know, hopefully, that it's not food that brought me pleasure and neither is it food that brings me disappointment. So the presence or the absence of something is not responsible for the way I feel. What is then? That is your expectation. This is your wanting something. In other words, again, attachment. And when you see that, you ask the question, okay, again, how? How is it that I'm attached to this? Why am I attached to this? I'm attached to this because, again, I was indoctrinated that pudding was pleasurable, joyful, and essenceful. Having accepted that indoctrination and having become indoctrined, now I've been looking for it. Spent all morning, all afternoon looking for it, and I come home and tea time only to realize that I'm not going to get pudding today. Utter disappointment. 99% of the world's population will react to this situation and then they'll have a go, either at the mother or someone else, saying, if you promise me, why didn't you give it to me? And then they'll get angry. But this is the wrong thing to do. Whenever they're doing that, as in taking it out on a person, see, they're asking the question, who? Who's responsible for my happiness? Who's responsible for my unhappiness? That is what we call, what is what the Buddha called, ayoniso manasikar. Incorrect contemplation. This is wrong contemplation. You're asking the question, who, and you're trying to find an answer. To either give them a pat on the back or give them a kick up the butt. Either one of these two things. You either like them or you dislike them. Why? Because you've asked the question, who? But instead, the question you ought to be asking is how? How is this happening right now? How is it that I'm feeling unhappy about this? Why am I feeling? How is it that I'm feeling disappointed? Now if you go through the process, the mental process, this is in your own mind. When you go through this mental process, you realize the mind program is bugged. It's buggy. There's a problem in the code. So now I need to debug it. So therefore, reprogram. So you use the Buddha's Dhamma, that is your model, and then based on that model, you rewrite the code. You don't have to start from scratch, you just need to rewrite the bit that's incorrect. The bit that throws an exception. The bit that throws an error. Because this is an error. So you see, when you contemplate on how this is happening, you find answers. And the same goes for delusion. As I said, one of the easier ways to spot delusion is where you feel feelings of ego, either superiority or inferiority. They are one of the easier ways to find it. Now, I'll agree that this is one of the more subtle ones. And there's a little bit more that I want to explain to you to crack this particular defilement. But for the time being, let's just say, when you feel that, perhaps that you are superior to someone or inferior to someone, again, you're asking the wrong question. You're asking who? Who am I feeling superior to? And who am I feeling inferior to? Go back and ask the question, how am I feeling this? We talked about the mind and body as the duality. There's a mind, there's a body. Whoever you talk of. Remember we spoke of Sam? Sam is mind and body. So where's Sam? So say you're feeling superior to someone. And you're having those thoughts of superiority. You're feeling superior to someone else. Look at that someone else for a moment. And say that person, Sam, for instance, you're feeling you're superior to Sam. I'm talking about the feeling of superiority, not whether, you know, say in a work environment, it may be that you are actually, by authority, superior to someone else. But I'm talking about the feeling of superiority, you know, that ugly feeling of, you know, I don't need to bow my head to him. I'm more important than him. Or that he's more important than me. I feel so small in his presence. I feel so weak in his presence, in his or her presence. You know, these are thoughts of inferior and superiority. They're defilements. So when you break it down to mind and body, then which is it that you are talking about now? Are you saying that you feel superior to his body or superior to his mind? A mind is just a mind. It's just a home for thoughts. And the thought simply arises to identify and recognize external stimuli. That's all a thought is. So how can you say that this thought that is within you is superior or inferior to another thought? What is the metric for that? Let me ask you this question. I'm going to click my fingers. You heard that, right? Is that superior or inferior to this? Let me try that again. I'm going to click my fingers one more time. Is that superior or inferior to? I just clapped. Is that superior or inferior to that? What's the answer? You realize the question does not make any sense. Why? Because it doesn't. That's just a sound. How can you say a sound is superior or inferior to another sound? In just the same way then, how can you say a thought which arose to identify and recognize a sound is superior or inferior to another thought? You can't say that, can you? It makes no sense to even ask that question. So that is an invalid question then. So then you realize that this feeling that I experience right now is invalid because you went through the process of how is this happening? Instead of asking who? Who am I inferior to? Who am I superior to? When you ask that question, immediately you're going to come with an answer, and that answer is based on ignorance. Of course, because ignorance's job is to tell you that which is not real as real and that which is real as not real. That is the role of ignorance. So it's doing its job perfectly. So instead of basing your questions on ignorance, base your questions on wisdom and ask the question, how? When you ask that question, what you're doing is called, wait for it, drum roll, it's called what? It's called meditation. When you observe what's going through the mind and ask the question how, that process is called meditation. That's it. Now tell me, how can you start to see flashes of light? How can you start to see ghosts? How can you start to feel levitating? How can you have a stiff neck or a cold forehead? How can your left ear start to twitch? How can you start dancing all of a sudden with absolute no control? How can you get shivers? How can you have fits You're just contemplating on how these thoughts are going through the mind. That's a process. You're simply analyzing the process. How can an examination of the mind cause any physical responses? I'm talking about pure contemplation. If you want to rid your mind of suffering, then this is how you ought to meditate. If you're going to use meditation for other things, then I have no advice for you. I have no suggestions for you. I cannot recommend a teacher. You're on your own. Because I don't use meditation for any other thing, therefore, I'm not the right person to be advising on that. Now again, as I say, this is not a direct answer to this question, but it's a very, very interesting and very important question that is raised by the listener. And he or she has opened up a really important and really interesting paradigm for us to discuss, or rather an arena for us to discuss. Now, in order to answer the question that has been put forward, when I started meditating today, my mind got stuck on one rupa, which is of my long deceased grandmother, whom I was very fond of and attached to. Right, okay. Now, what must you do? First things first. What's the first thing you do? Desire, aversion, or delusion? I think you can find the answer in here. My mind got stuck on one rupa, which is my long deceased grandmother, whom I was very fond of and attached to. Though that's not aversion. Perhaps a tiny bit of delusion, we'll talk about that later, but there's always going to be desire. Right? I couldn't proceed beyond this even though I tried to look at it in terms of the nature and cause of attachment. This particular rupa and associated chitta just very stubbornly remained etched, and I got panicked and came out of my meditation. So what must he or she have done at that point? They go on to say that I was too agitated and scared to resume my meditation. Right, okay, so when you resume your meditation, what must you do from this point forward? Ask the question what? Who? You can ask the question who. Who is your grandmother? I saw my grandmother. Who? I saw my grandmother. Oh, good Lord. Where must she be right now? Maybe she's a goddess. Maybe she's a demon. Maybe she's a spirit. Now immediately you've taken the wrong diversion. But rather, if you ask the question, how? What's going on in my mind? Then you already have the answer. You started off with very fond of and attached to. Why the fondness? Why the attachment? Because when you have thoughts of your grandmother, you're going to have thoughts of desire. As in, when I say desire, you've got to understand that this is, any thoughts of pleasure. You don't take desire in the wrong way. Oh, that's only one way of desire, the sensual desire. All of this is desire. So then you have a thought of desire. And then? That thought of desire is now to be analyzed by asking the question, how? So we ask the question, how? Pleasure is experienced through relief from vexation. And vexation is caused by attachment. Attachment is caused by ignorance. In other words, there's some indoctrination in the mind that tells this person that the grandmother is pleasurable. But is the grandmother pleasurable? Or rather, is it relief from vexation that is the source of pleasure? If your grandmother was pleasurable, then her presence or thoughts of her should bring pleasure to everyone. Yes or no? But it may be that she had some people who were not very friendly with her. Maybe they didn't like her very much. So thoughts of her are not going to bring fond memories to those people. Meaning then, or implying thus, that your grandmother or this person is not a source of pleasure. So what is the source of pleasure? Really, from vexation is the source of pleasure. Vexation is a function of the mind. It is in fact the product of the function of attachment. The mind can either attach or remain detached. As soon as the mind is attached, now the mind is vexed. Now the mind wants it. And then those thoughts which the mind wanted, when the mind is fed with them, the mind is relieved from vexation, because that is what it was waiting for. The fulfillment of expectation, satisfaction. You see, when you go through this mental process in your mind, now, every time you go through this process, you are now attributing pleasure away from your grandmother to the relief from vexation process. This is the reprogramming that needs to happen in the mind through meditation. In other words, that is meditation. It is the reattribution of pleasure and the reattribution of disappointment, the reattribution of positive and negative emotions. They don't come from the objects. They don't come from the senses. They simply come from vexation and the relief from vexation. And also the loss of the opportunity to relieve from vexation. This is the source. And when you realize that this is where all of these thoughts spring out of, then you realize, oh, hang on a second. So attachment is the problem every single time. It's not the presence or the absence of the grandmother. So if attachment is the problem, now my issue is with attachment, not with my grandmother. So what must we try and get rid of? Thoughts of grandmother or attachment? Which one of these two should we try and get rid of? Did the thought of grandmother bring us any problem? No, it was only attachment that was problematic. So which one should we fight with? Try and, you know, go back to the email. This particular rupa and its associated chitta just very stubbornly remained etched, and I got panicked and came out of my meditation. Why? Because the problem was seen as the grandmother. Poor grandmother. I'm sure she must have been a lovely grandmother. And to think that she has caused you panic. Tut, tut, tut. Not very nice. Poor grandmother, let her be. It's not her fault. Problem is with attachment. I was too agitated and scared to resume meditation. No, you shouldn't be. Why? Because when you go through the process of how, you begin to realize that attachment is still in the mind. Therefore, what's there to be agitated or scared? You see, you're agitated and scared because you ask the question, who? Good Lord, it's my long-lost, diseased grandmother. Whereas if it was your living grandmother, right? Maybe it was a living friend or a parent or a cousin or a brother, it wouldn't have been that much of a problem. But immediately when people think, oh my God, they're dead, I'm thinking of the dead, oh good Lord, I'm scared. That can happen to people, and that does happen to people. And then they're scared, because people are generally scared of the dead. Is that fair? Completely unfair, because dead people cause no harm. If anything, they're harmless. It's people who are alive that you need to watch out for. When was the last time a dead person gave you a kick or gave you a slap? When was the last time a dead person shouted at you or hurt your feelings? When was the last time a dead person robbed a bank? See, dead people, I don't know what the deal with these people and dead people. Just let them be. And people say, rest in peace, and they put a tombstone, and then they just don't let them rest in peace. From the day they're dead, people just carry on insulting them. I have a bone to pick with people who have a bone to pick with dead people. I'm like, let dead people be, seriously. They're innocent. It's the people who are alive and walking about and around us, that's the people we need to watch out for. Be careful. So anyway, coming back to the point, when you ask the question, who, now you get dead grandmother as the answer. And now, yes, it's terrifying. It can be, because she's dead. But if you ask the question, how is this happening in my mind? Now you're not so worried. You realize, well, it's attachment. Attachment is the problem. So if attachment still remains in my mind, is coming out of my meditation what I need to be doing right now? Or continue with my meditation and kick the butt out of attachment? That's what you need to do. You will only be able to do this if you ask the question, how? And then also, ultimately, there's also the delusion part. I said there's a bit of delusion. I'm not going to talk about it at great length today, but just for the sake of completeness. Right? Like we asked the question, where's Sam? I'm going to have to ask the question, where's grandmother? There's mind, there's body. Where's grandmother? The purpose of the mind is simply to identify and recognize. So for as long as your grandmother was alive, there was the mind that operated within her body, or within the body that she used to call my body. And in that mind, whenever you showed a sight, a thought arose. Whenever you presented a sound, a thought arose. Whenever you presented a taste, a thought arose. Right? Smell, touch, a thought arose. So essentially, thoughts simply arose in that mind when a stimulus was presented to one of the five sense organs. That was the function of the mind. It's the same thing that's happening right now in your mind, or in this mind that you call your mind. So what's the difference? So if there's no difference, why do you call yourself yourself, and why do you call your grandmother grandmother? Essentially, they're all the same. It's just a mind. And then the body, when you break it down, is simply muscle and bone. So where's grandmother? But let's not get too hung up on that. We'll talk about that later. For the time being, right, first identify whether it's desire, aversion, or delusion, and then work through how that's happening in this mind, using the principle of attachment, ignorance causes attachment, attachment causes vexation, and then relief from that vexation causes pleasure. And the lack of opportunity to relieve from vexation causes disappointment, which is that sensation of displeasure or aversion. So that is all comprehensible, is it not? So then, does it matter then that the thought of the grandmother remains in the mind? It lingers in the mind and it continues to do so? That's not a problem. Because the grandmother is not the problem. Attachment is the problem. But if attachment remains stubbornly in the mind, now we have a problem and we ought to panic. Panic how? Well, just continue with meditation until we get it out of the mind. Because attachment is what we're trying to get rid of, not grandmother. Or any other, for that matter. We have no problem with the sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or even memories. None of those things are sources of suffering. And none of those things are sources of pleasure either, to the mind. Physical touch can be a source of pleasure or pain to the body, but not to the mind. So, we must not struggle. We must not fight. It's a losing battle. If you try to rid the mind of thoughts or mental objects, whether that's a live person or a dead person, or whether it's a big object or a small object or a far object or a near object or a big object, it does not matter. Or an object from the past, the present, or the future. our efforts in meditation is not to try and rid the mind of the thoughts or of the mental objects that based on which those thoughts have arisen. I mean, that would kind of defeat the purpose, wouldn't it? If you're trying to get rid of the object, how would the thought arise? Then the thought wouldn't arise. And without the thought arising, how can you meditate? Because ultimately, meditation is cleansing the mind with thoughts, right thoughts.
Nekkamma sankappana, avihinsa sankalpana, and avyapada sankalpana. That's the right thoughts in the Noble Eightfold Path.
So if you rid the mind of mental objects, then how can, you know, thoughts are not going to arise in the mind. And when thoughts don't arise, how can you complete the Noble Eightfold Path? That's what we need to understand. We are not trying to get rid of the mental objects or the thoughts. We are trying to get rid of attachment. Attachment is only caused by ignorance. Ignorance is telling us something that is not true, showing the truth as false and then the false as truth. So, no matter what that mental object is, whether it's a grandmother or your mother, whether it's a piece of cake or a biscuit pudding, whatever the case might be that a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, touch, or a thought, whatever the case might be, to think that it's that is the source of pleasure or suffering or pain is incorrect. Both of those mental sensations are the product of vexation, which is caused by attachment, which is based in ignorance. And ignorance is the wrong idea, it's the wrong understanding, the wrong concept that pleasure and vexation come from the object. That is wrong. Once that is corrected, once that is rectified, your problem is sorted. I would be grateful if you could advise me as to how I could handle a situation like this and proceed with the meditation. So I hope you have found an answer. That's a good question, a very good question indeed. A good question which actually opened up quite a large area for meditators, especially newbie meditators, as much as advanced meditators. In the beginning, the start of the sermon, what I explained to you was the pitfalls of meditation. Watch out for them. I'll be the last person to say not to meditate. Meditation is good, done correctly. Meditation, if done incorrectly, is the worst, most lethal weapon that I've ever heard of. It can completely destroy you and everything and everyone around you. So use it with care. And that's not to say be worried of it or scared of it. Just do as you have received instruction. If you do as I have just explained to you, I'm speaking responsibly. Because this is what I've done thus far, and it has only done me good. Because in my meditation, all I'm doing is trying to rid the mind of suffering, and I don't use meditation for anything else. So if you do the same, then no harm can come. If you have followed what I've said to the letter, then I'll vouch for the fact that you are not going to go astray. But if you try all sorts of other things, like start to experience the world around you, or try and set your mind to other thoughts, or try to feel the energies or the vibrations, or you know, the third eyes and all that other things that are going on around the world, right? If you want to try and do those things, then I'm afraid I can't help you there, because I don't know what that is all about. So I can't help. And I hope that's fair enough. I can't advise you on something I don't know. Okay? So let's try and do that. And hopefully that has answered the question from this listener. And I'm grateful for the question, because I think it's a question that is probably has been and is on the mind of many a meditator. For most people who want to break through into the practice of meditation. And it's a good thing to do. I emphasize that, right? It's not something to shy away from. I've always said practice Arya Maitreya, the noble meditation. Noble Metta. It's the meditation that I've done ever since I started my practice as a Buddhist. And it's what I do to this day. With every iteration of it, my contemplation of the Dhamma and the truth of life becomes more profound. So I don't need to change my meditation object. I don't need to change my karmasthana. Rather, I stick to the same karmasthana and I just continue to examine myself and the thoughts that come in my mind. That to me is what meditation is. You don't need two karmasthanas. You just need one, and you've got to do it right. But most times people are too lazy. People always want something new, something fancy. So they want the whatever the latest hype is about. So if someone comes along and gives a new karmasthana, then everybody wants that. And sometimes your teacher gives you a meditation object, a karmasthana. You practice that, and then the next day you hear some other meditation teacher giving another karmasthana, and then people want that. So they stop the meditation karmasthana given by one teacher and start doing the one from another teacher. Problem is, both teachers will achieve their ambition because they're both practicing a single karmasthana. But problem is, the student, they keep jumping around. And they keep changing the karmasthana, and they'll never get to any goal. All they'll have done at the end of it is have become a jack of all trades, but a king of none. You can't get to an ambition and a destination like that. Take one road and walk that path. If you keep jumping from one path to the other, you're going to get lost. And how many plans can you follow to get from A to B? Now you have three plans, all drawn differently. Three roads. So it says 10 miles to get from A to B. 1 mile you go along to one plan, and then the second mile you go along to the next plan, or next the other map, and then the third mile you walk along to the according to the third map, and then you revert back to the first map. Are you going to get to your destination? No. But all three people who've drawn each of those maps, they drew those maps because they used those paths to get to their destination, and they stuck to that path. That's how they go to their destination. That's what I'm saying. The teachers aren't wrong. The teachers are right. Most teachers. If they have walked the path, if they have achieved results, then they ought to be right. But as a student, if you keep jumping ship, you won't get anywhere. That's why it's important to stick to one plan and then follow through with it until you get to your result. So, thank you again for the question. It's a great question, and hopefully one that was very helpful for most. All right, so on that note then, we'll conclude today's sermon. And I hope you all prepared yourselves for the new year. This is the first sermon you're getting in the new year. I hope you all gone back to your game plans and made sure that it's all nice and tidied up. You've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and made sure that it's all aligned and you've got your bearings right, and it's all calibrated and you're ready to go and geared up for a brand new year. Right? Just as you did in the previous year, continue with your focus, continue with the same energy in the new year. I'll continue to support you, and as the Mahasangha, we will continue to support you as best we can. As long as there's a will, there's a way. You just make sure you have a will. It will make the way available to you. Okay? Remember, you are blessed. One, to have been born human. Two, to have been born in the era of the Buddha's doctrine, dispensation. Three, to understand and listen to these words. And four, to be blessed. You are blessed to have a family of Kalyanamittas. So that's not just a Swami Nuhansi, the Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni Upasaka and Upasika. You are blessed to have all four of these, who are always willing and ready to help and support you along the way. So make use of it. And make this year a year of success. And we can do that. Resolve, determination, willpower, and the right attitude will get you a long way. And we'll be along the way to help you at each step of the way. As promised last week, we also have a gift, a New Year gift to all of you. And particularly, not just for you, but also your friends and family who live abroad. Perhaps those who are not familiar with Sinhala, or maybe those who you have struggled thus far to introduce to the English sermons for one reason or another. And we understand that sometimes one of those reasons is the fact that most other sermons you get to see the face of the Swami Nuhansi delivering the sermon, but with our sermons not so much, unless you actually come into the monastery. So as promised last week, we have made available a bunch of sermons that were delivered at the monastery with the videos to go along with them on a new YouTube channel. Details of the YouTube channel you will be able to find in the chat as well as in the description of this YouTube stream. So just click on that and you should be able to find it. The channel itself, I think, is called Jetavanarama Buddhist Monastery. And on that channel, we will only be hosting English material. So it may be that in the past you attempted to introduce your friends to the Jetavanarama Vihara YouTube channel, but of course on there we have the Sinhala sermons, English sermons, oh, and also sprinkled with a few Hindi sermons. But going forward, we will start to make available, and the plan is to make one available each week. So particularly the sermons that were done in the past, and there will be a good channel to introduce someone to Buddhism as well as to introduce someone to the path that you have all followed and with conviction you believe is the path to your salvation. So if you believe this, should you do this? Don't otherwise. Share this link with others, particularly those who may be residents of other countries throughout the world. Perhaps they've never seen Swami Nuhansi, so they find it difficult to put a face to the voice. Sometimes, you know, with communication, that's an important aspect of it. So when you can put a face to a name, or at least a face to a voice, then it's easier to follow. Most of you will have come to the monastery on various occasions to meet the Swami Nuhansis, but there are some who haven't. And I think we have a growing population of listeners who join us from other countries. And of course, we are always welcoming of them. And we wanted to give this as a gift in the new year, because we want this year to be a very special year for all. A year in which we change ourselves. We change for the better. And I know quite a few of you have attempted to help others transform their lives and others enter the path of the Dhamma. And we want to do as much as we possibly can to help. So those sermons will be posted one a week. I think there are a few already on the channel. They'll be posted one a week going forward. That is the plan, certainly. With help from all of you, you have always continued to help with the dissemination of the Dhamma, and please continue to do so for the sake of merits. And always think about the benefit and how much good it will do to others, all people around the world. Remember, in Sinhala, we can do as many sermons as we like, but we are targeting a very, very, very minute proportion of the global population. But given we have the ability to deliver these sermons in English and in future in other languages also, we must, this is our duty, to give as much as we possibly can to others, because we know how much we have gained from listening to these sermons and from understanding them, and how much they have changed our lives for the better. You have sent us testimonials to that effect, to prove that. And I mean, you know, that is the proof. What else can we ask for, right? And of course, we understand what it has happened, what it has done to us. Remember, what you give is what you get. We know that principle, and we have tested it, we've tried it, and we know it works. So there are many countless scores of people out there, many millions of people out there, billions of people out there who understand English, to whom English is maybe a first language or at least a second language. Let us start making this Dhamma available to all of them. Let us introduce them slowly, steadily, and let us give the gift of the Buddha. Let us give the gift of the noble lineage of all the arahants who have, with their life, sacrificed their life to bring this Dhamma all the way down to us. All the members of the noble lineage, all the Aryans who have struggled thus far to bring the Dhamma all the way down to us, let us do our duty and pass on their gift to us, their legacy to us, to all of humanity. You have a huge part to play there, because you are a living, breathing specimen that the Dhamma works. Remember, I asked you to always become a Dhamma Jiva. Unless you have taken this, absorbed this, and changed yourself, don't go on to give something you don't believe in. We don't want a salesman. We want an evangelist. And I think that is what you have become now. Because you know, you believe with conviction that this Dhamma has paved the path to a better you. Help people around the world who are struggling to find a happiness that has always been evasive to them, because they just don't know what they need to do to be happy. They're doing everything but that, because they have not met the Buddha. They have not seen the Buddha. They don't know what the Buddha is as much. They certainly may know who the Buddha is, but they don't know what the Buddha is. So let us show them what the Buddha is. If we give the Buddha, we will get the Buddha. So we have all done a lot to make these sermons available and possible. Transcriptions will also be made available, thanks to a whole bunch of you who are meticulously putting in time and effort to make the transcriptions available, as well as time logging and a whole bunch of facilities and features to make these sermons more accessible. The plan is to make them available in print form as well in the future. So there's a whole lot of things we are planning on doing in the new year. And you have always been there to help with all that, because you understand the tremendous amount of merits that come out of it, and we have a growing team of supporters. So long may that continue, and may all those merits help you all on your path to your salvation, and may it see you through that path with as little difficulty as possible, and may it help you walk that path without obstacles, and help you all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Okay, let us take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting Pirit, and listening to the Dhamma, and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha, and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand, and comprehend Dhamma. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that among them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to Guru Swami Nivans and all other monks resident at this monastery, as well as the Anagarika and the Anagarika community attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits and express our gratitude to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May, through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May, through the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer the merits we have acquired to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who have passed on their know-how and extend their well wishes. And may through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, employers and employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form. And by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Sambuddha Shasana. Let us also transfer merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May through the power of these merits they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all who have been our families and friends, acquaintances, in this infinitely long journey in samsara, and who have helped and supported us, assisted us in every way they could. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to them. Let us also transfer merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who have sacrificed their lives on numerous occasions to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. And may all who have lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe, rejoice in the merits we have acquired today. Let us also transfer merits to all those who have lost their lives in natural calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides and pandemics, reminding ourselves that among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey in samsara. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to them. And may through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in woeful planes, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, let us all resolve that may through the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahat and Mahanses on this blessed land. And finally, may through the power of all the merits we have acquired today, you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become an Arahat Unvahanse or an Arahat Mehinin Vahanse in this very life and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We will now conclude the sermon on that note, and may the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all.